This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salam ala ashrafil anbiya wal mursaleen. Nabiyyina Muhammad alayhi afdalus salah wa iska taslim. We have a little talk, inshallah, before the potluck. I hope this is also an opportunity for people to ask questions. So my rule for today is that I'm not going to take any of the men's questions until we finish with the women's questions. So you should have received papers on the women's side to write down your questions. And then we will get to them, and then we'll get to the men's questions. Just because in my experience, and no offense to the men, I start with the men's questions, mashallah, tabarakallah. There's so many questions, we never get to the women's questions. And then, you know, the women get upset at me. So we'll try to remedy that, inshallah. So the title of this talk is Establishing Islam in our Hearts and Our Homes. And I think this talk is significant at this time of the year because we have just finished Ramadan. And we're all feeling we have a lot of momentum, I think. Ramadan is really an amazing opportunity that Allah has given us year in and year out. It's a testament to our faith as Muslims that despite the hardship that we go through, every single one of us, we're sad to see Ramadan go. You know, nobody realizes this more than the non-Muslims, people who aren't Muslims. They hear about fasting, they hear about what we do, and they're amazed. And they say, how can you go through this? And then when they hear about Eid, they're like, oh, you must be glad it's over. And every one of us is like, no, we wish every month for Ramadan. That's the usual response that they get. They can't comprehend that kind of attitude. So that's a testament to our faith. And it's a testament to the Sharia of Allah, that Allah could structure an act of worship that is so perfect that it's difficult and it's challenging. But we grow so much and we feel so inspired by the end of the month that by the time we get to the end of it, we're ready for more. We're ready to do it again. There's other parts of Ramadan that if you think about, if you sit and think about, you realize how Allah structured it for our own benefit. One of these ways is the upending and the uprooting and the disturbance of our habits. Ramadan touches our most intimate habits, sleep, food, things that throughout the year normally, you know, if you go without your coffee before you get to work, you might be a very crabby person. Somehow in Ramadan, we find a way to do it. Whether we tuck it in after Maghrib or after Isha or however we do it, we find a way. We restructure our whole lives in order to accomplish the will of Allah. It's almost as if we're tilling a piece of land. If you guys have lawns, you have grass growing there. You want other things to grow in that lawn. Maybe you want to plant a maple tree or something else. You want to have a garden. You have to disturb what's there first. You have to pull out the grass. You have to maybe let the weeds bloom and then kill them off. And then the ground is ready for something new. It's no incident that we disrupt these habits in Ramadan, because guess what? Ramadan is to prepare you for something new. Ramadan is uprooting your habits to prepare you for new habits when you're done Ramadan, when you're over. So all of that momentum that you had, the Quran that you read, the prayers that you made, okay, no one's expecting that you're going to be, you know, going for the same amount of time. However, every Ramadan is an opportunity to insert into our daily lives throughout the year something of those other acts of worship that we were doing in Ramadan. And Allah gave it to us in a brilliantly constructed gift, that is that month. So we look about our lives now. It's been what? It's been 2 weeks, I think, since Ramadan finished. Or three, I'm not sure, subhanAllah. We have two choices. Either we can leave the ground idle and not do anything with it, not plant any seeds, and then just kind of neglect it until we get back to it next year. And we're going to find the same grass, all the seeds that were left over have already bloomed, and we're back to the same starting point. We're back to the drawing board. We're back to ground zero. Or we can take advantage of this time. We can take advantage of this time and plant new seeds to get something else out of it. So this whole entire talk is essentially how to do that. How are we going to convert the spiritual experience of Ramadan and turn it into something that is sustainable throughout the year, so that once we get to the next Ramadan, we actually can see some progress. We actually can say, look, I remember where I was 5 years ago. I'm a totally different person now. I have my habits are so much better, and I'm so much closer to Allah, and I feel so much closer to Allah. I feel like a stronger person of faith. That is the goal. So how are we going to talk about this? We're going to look at it at three kind of levels. We're going to look at it first at the level of the individual human being, because we're all individuals. We're going to look at it at the level of family, because we're all part of a family. And we're going to look at it at the level of community, because alhamdulillah, we all are part of a community here. When it comes to the self, so going into the first one, when it comes to the self, we're really talking about two major things. And the scholars have talked about this, especially among them, Ibn al-Qayyim, rahimahullah, where our battle or our work has to do with our intention. Because the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he said, "Innama al-a'malu bin-niyyat." That's right. Every single action is nothing except it has the proper intention. And so there's a dual thing going on. One of the things that we're trying to do is we're trying to rescue our acts of worship from the realm of habit, mindless habit. We're trying to take our ibadah back from adah. And the other kind of move that we're trying to do is we're trying to look at our habits, at our adat, the things we do every day, and convert them into ibadah. It's not easy, but we're going to get into, inshallah, some things how. So, taking the first one, we stand in prayer. We dedicate perhaps an hour of a day to prayer. If you tally up every minute, you leave your house, you go to the masjid, you make wudu, you make your dhikr, and the actual act of praying itself, it probably, most of us, maybe comes out to an hour a day. How is that hour spent? Do you feel like that hour, do you feel like you're actually, subhanAllah, standing in front of Allah, you know, complaining to Allah about your own self, about your own inabilities, relying upon Him? Or is it the way it is for me a lot of the time, and I'm guessing you probably some of the time, where you're in a rush, you're thinking about other things, you're distracted. You don't feel like you're getting everything out of it. How do we reclaim this act of worship? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He said, وَأَقِمِ الصَّلَاةَ إِنَّ الصَّلَاةَ تَنْهَى عَنِ الْفَحْشَاءِ وَالْمُنْكَرِ. Allah said, He made us a promise, He told us a khabr here, information. He says, listen, the salah that I legislated for you, it prevents you from committing fahsha and munkar. It prevents you from committing evil deeds and spreading corruption on earth. Question, this is going to be interactive, by the way. Question, are there people who pray who commit evil deeds? Yeah, of course. So is Allah lying to us? How do we reconcile the ayah with the reality? Allah said the salah prevents evil. There's people who make salah who commit evil. Ashan makhraj.
They didn't reach the level of the khushu' in the salah.
Okay, yeah, exactly. Is it the salah that Allah is talking about in the ayah? Is our salah, salah haqiqatan, or surat al-salah? Is our salah the same salah? Can we say that our salah is the same salah that Allah is legislating? Because Allah is saying, you must stand before me in khushu', in fear, in reverence, in awe, conscious of me, ascribing nothing else with me in worship, and not just worship of sujood and zakah, no, worship of fear and love. Can we really say that we're doing that? The Prophet ﷺ, he affirmed this in a hadith. He said, "Inna al-abda yaqum fi salah la yuktabu lahu minha illa nisfuha, illa thuluthuha, illa rubu'uha, illa khumusuha, hatta qala illa ushruha." He said, perhaps, certainly, someone's going to stand in prayer, and they're not going to get anything out of it. They're not going to have anything written for them, except maybe half of it, maybe a third of it. maybe a quarter of it. And he kept on going down and down and down. You can have two people doing the same thing at the same time, right next to each other. One person might be getting 100% out of their salah, and one person might be getting 1%, very, very little. And so our intention and our sincerity is the difference between these two people. Intention and sincerity is the difference between prayer and exercise. It's moving the limbs. Sincerity is the difference between fasting and starving. The Prophet ﷺ said, "Rubba sa'imin hadhuhu min siyamihi al-ju' wal-atash." Maybe there's someone who's fasting and the only thing he's benefiting from his fasting is hunger and thirst. Intention is the difference. Intention and sincerity, they're the difference between pilgrimage and vacation. Some people can go to Mecca and Medina and make and walk around the Kaaba and they still haven't made pilgrimage. They've gone on vacation. It's in their Facebook feeds, it's in their Instagram, just so you know. It's possible. Depends on your intention, depends on your sincerity. Why does this happen? Why do we find ourselves so easily drugged down into habit? Why do our acts of worship become meaningless when they're supposed to be so transformative in our lives? One reason has to do with our ideas about what we're doing in the first place. What is this religion? What's this faith that we're practicing? And what do we expect out of it? Do we imagine our religion as a culture or part of our culture simply? Do we think that our religion is something we're entitled to? Do we expect, because my name is Muhammad, or my name is Saeed, or my name is Fatima, or my name is Su'ad, that I'm going to be in Jannah? It's my birthright, because I've been born into it? Or is it something that is a craft? Is it something that is like a skill that you hone every day, just like a professional athlete repeats the same bodily motions every day until it's perfect, until it becomes muscle memory? Obviously, the latter. Religion is not so much an identity, although there's parts of it that are identity, as it is a practice and a path. And we accept this when we look at other parts of our lives. You guys are, most of you, mashallah, tabarakallah, professionals. Okay? If you're a professional, 10 years, 15 years pass, 20 years, you haven't done any professional development. You haven't upgraded your licenses. What's going to happen to you? You're going to get fired, or you're at least, you know, you're going to get laid off at some point, or your pay is going to not be as good, you're not going to progress. So we know when it comes to our dunya, when it comes to our money, we don't accept this attitude of entitlement. We know we have to be a go-getter. You have to go out and look for what's going to improve. Whatever is the newest technology that comes into the hospital, you need to be trained on it. You need to learn how to use it. However, somehow we don't have this idea when it comes to our faith, when it comes to Islam. We don't think that we need to do anything. We literally think that we can show up and do the same thing every year and we're going to get better. Or at least hold on. The situation is much more dangerous because in the business world, if you don't add anything to yourself, to your credentials or to your knowledge base, you might stay the same. You might plateau. But when it comes to our religion, there's another variable in the equation. It's you and it's your religion and it is the devil. And the devil is trying constantly to bring you down step by step. So religion is different. Your faith is different than your occupation or your profession or your education. There is no standing still. It's a moving train. You're either going forwards or you're going backwards. So what can we do? We look at our worship and we think, okay, my worship's in a sad state. It's mostly just going through the motions. I don't really feel it. I don't really feel the magnificence of Allah when I stand before Allah. What can we do? One of the things, very, very nuts and bolts thing that we can do is take our time. The Prophet ﷺ, he once praised one of the companions, Ash-Shajj Abdul Qais, he said, "Inna fika khaslatain yuhibbuhum Allah, al-hilm wal-ana." said you have two qualities that Allah loves, forbearance and taking your time, the opposite of haste. We expect, we come through that door and we walk into the prayer. Some of us are talking up until the point where we say the takbir. Some of us are on our phones until the point when we say the takbir. And we expect that we're just going to flip the switch and somehow just like feel like we're standing in front of Allah Almighty. That's insanity. It's not possible. And if you think for a second about the Sharia and what Allah asked us to do, or what Allah encouraged us to do, He gave us signs of what to do. Just like a marathon. If you're a marathon runner, let's say the brother here, what's your name?
Ibrahim.
Ibrahim wants to run a marathon. Guess what? Utica's going to have the first marathon. I don't think Utica has marathons, do they? Utica's going to have a marathon tomorrow, Saturday. And Ibrahim says, you know what? Bismillah, tawakkalallah. Yalla, let's go. Let's do it. He's going to show up tomorrow. And he's just going, you know what? I'm going to bang this out. Let's do it. How's he going to do? He's going to probably pull his hamstring or his quad or something. It's going to be a mess. He might not even finish. Ma'adallah. You know, I don't want any harm to you. But I'm just saying, you know, straight up. Okay, so what's necessary? We have training. We have stretching. We have a cool down period after. All these sorts of things that we know. Okay, Allah gave us this for our prayer and for the other acts of worship. The time between the adhan and the iqamah is time for dhikr. It's time for spiritual preparation. And the Prophet ﷺ said that there's two raka'ah for anybody who wants between the adhan and the iqamah. It's isti'dad. It's getting yourself ready. It's submitting your heart. It's dress rehearsal. The same with the sunnah rawatib, the sunnah prayers that are attached to the obligatory prayers. The two before Fajr and the two after Maghrib. And the ones after Isha and the ones bookending Dhuhr. These are like runways for you to take off. If you come to the masjid with wudu already, like the Prophet ﷺ recommended, and then you spend your time in dhikr and waiting and in extra prayer before the salah comes, how much more ready do you think your prayer is going to be once you actually get to the real deal, the one that really counts? Fasting is the same thing. It's actually miraculous that we all do so well as a community as we do during Ramadan. Because most of us, let's be real, don't fast during the year. And we go into this thing cold turkey, 30 days, without having fasted maybe once or twice throughout the year before it. And that first week is just, you're getting hit with your headache and your caffeine withdrawal and all those other things. Right? It's an opportunity cost. You're being deprived of benefit because if you were in the habit already, if you were doing the full moon days, if you were doing Mondays and Thursdays throughout the year, and then you get to Ramadan, you're ready to go. You're not going to feel the effects as much. Allah also structured fasting the same way as He did Salah. The extra acts of worship that are part of the Sunnah are a mercy to us, so that we derive as much benefit as possible. There's also another thing going on, and this is completely up here. This is completely mental. Is that we live in a society that is a lot about entertainment and leisure. And so a lot of us have developed a skewed understanding of what our downtime should be. We think that downtime is relaxing in front of the TV or watching Netflix or doing these other sorts of things. For the Prophet ﷺ, his downtime and his leisure was the salah. He used to say to Bilal, give us rest with the adhan, when he was asking Bilal to make the adhan. So it's a whole different kind of perspective. You work hard and you look forward to the acts of worship punctuating your day because that's your rest. And inshallah, that will put more blessing in it. How else can we prevent our worship from becoming mere habit? How else can we prevent it from becoming hollow and static? There are many ways to elevate our knowledge and accordingly our faith. You can attend lessons at the masjid, of course. You guys, mashallah, from what I understand, you have lessons. Anybody who's able to come and benefit, they will benefit. Allah says in the Quran, وَذَكِّرْ فَإِنَّ ذِكْرَ تَنْفَعُ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ. Any sort of remembrance or reminder is going to benefit the believing heart. That's a promise that Allah made you. We make time for the Quran and not just memorization, but meditating upon it. Pondering, what is Allah trying to tell you? We can, and I know a lot of you are going to roll your eyes at this, we can learn Arabic. A lot of us are ready to learn languages for business, but we're not ready to learn a language for subhanahu wa ta'ala, for Allah. Allah said that the wahi is Arabiyya Mubin, meaning it's clear in Arabic. The hujjah, the fact that this, the words chosen are proof upon a people, are contingent upon the fact that they are also in Arabic. Those are the words Allah spoke, Kalamullah. You don't have to become Sibawayh, but if you try and you start, you will find a difference. Wallahi, I've been in Medina for 5 years now. I would not exchange anything for the ability to stand behind the Imam and understand the words of Allah. It is the most significant thing that will bring you closer to Allah. And it's something that a lot of us kind of, we disqualify ourselves. We kind of count ourselves out. I can't do it. I don't have time, whatever. You have people, mashallah, in this community. And I believe you also have classes. And it is a game changer. Another thing we can do is identify the acts of worship that we're not doing. I'm talking about a connection with Allah. There's some acts of worship that we're not doing or not doing properly. A lot of us save up for vacations and we have not made Umrah. It's a reality. Raise your hand if you're a Shafi'i, if you follow the Shafi'i madhab. Raise your hand if you're a Hanbali. Okay, Umrah is wajib upon you in those madhab. The Hanafis and the Malikis, they say it's mustahab. There's no ikhtilaf that Hajj is mandatory upon you. However, many of us, it's priorities. We manage to go back to the homeland every year, but we never manage to go to the call, answer the call of Allah. That's a problem. A lot of us don't pay our zakat at all, or don't pay it correctly. I read an article the other day that said if every Muslim in the world paid zakat properly, then it's estimated that the poverty of the entire world could be lifted. This is all within the first half. We're talking about trying to break up the habit, trying to break up the routine. Now let's look at being an opportunist, converting those daily things that we're already doing anyway into worship. Things that we do, things that are biological necessities can be worship for you. Your sleep can become worship for you. If you have that intention, when you lay down your head on your pillow, you say the things that the Prophet ﷺ used to say, Bismika Allahumma amut wa ahya. Or if you can't speak Arabic, you just say, you know, Allah, this is for you. I'm resting, so tomorrow I can come back and worship you another day. When you eat, you say Bismillah. You convert that act of biology. You have to eat or else you're going to drop dead. If you just say Bismillah and you mean it, guess what? That's something that's going to sit in your scale on the day of Yawm Qiyamah. Going to work, something that's a necessity. It's something you need to provide for your families. And it's something that can also be an act of worship if you have the intention. You say, I'm going out to do something that Allah requires of me. I'm going to make my living. I'm going to establish myself economically, independently. I'm going to support my family. This can easily be worship. Intimacy with your spouse is worship. Intimacy with your spouse is worship. The companions, they once complained to the Prophet ﷺ. He said, Ya Rasulullah, ذَهَبَ أَهْلُ الدُّثُورِ بِالْأُجُورِ. And you know the rest of the hadith. Poor people come to the Prophet ﷺ and they complain. They say, listen, the rich people, they've made out with all of the reward with Allah. Why? Because they pray just like we pray. And they fast just like we fast. And on top of that, they have their money to give and they're always giving their money. How are we going to beat them? How are we going to come out on top? And so the Prophet ﷺ, he responded to change their idea of what sadaqah was and what charity was. He says, listen, you've got other opportunities for charity or for sadaqah that you're sleeping on. Other opportunities for worship. He said, a smile is worship. He said, being intimate with your spouse is worship. They were amazed. They said, Ya Rasulullah, are you telling us that one of us has desires for his spouse and Allah is going to reward him for it? And the Prophet ﷺ responded, he said, what do you think about the one who has desires and does something haram? is there penalty for him? Is he held accountable for that? I said, yeah, of course. I said, okay, likewise, if you do it in a halal way, then it is for you. It is in your scale of good deeds. The companions, they used to say Bismillah every time they lowered a bucket down the well. Imagine if we took the time to say Bismillah every time we turned on our faucets. How much blessing Allah would put in our lives, and how much we would be training ourselves to constantly remember Allah throughout every single instance of our days. So if we convert these small things into worship, and if we can convert them, which we can, if we can align our everyday routines with Islam, can we also align the big things in our lives? Our major relationships, our major life decisions, so that they too are worship? Yes, absolutely we can. Where you decide to live can be a religious decision. How close are you to the masjid? What kind of amenities are you comparing? Say, oh, well, I want to be in this neighborhood because this school and this. Where's the masjid? Did the masjid enter into that calculation? That can be an act of worship. Who you marry? We know the Prophet ﷺ said that women are married for four things, and the best one is for their religion. But not just who you marry, but how you are married. When your spouse comes home from a long day, and you're tired, and maybe you haven't had your coffee yet, and she starts talking to you, or he starts talking to you, ladies, and you just don't really want to listen, and you're just kind of tuning them out, or you're looking on your phone, or you're like, not now, let's talk later, I'm too tired. You've just taken an opportunity that Allah gave you in your hands for worship, and you've just flushed it down the drain. Your relationship, there's a reason why Allah, this, or the Prophet ﷺ, describes your relationship with your spouse as half of your religion. Because most of your time is spent with your wives, most of your time is spent with your families. Every interaction, every little thing that you can do that makes her happy, that makes him happy, that can be worship for you. And think about the blessing that Allah will put in your relationship if that's the attitude you have to it, towards it. Who you allocate your time to in general, who you befriend, it can also be worship. A lot of times, especially you young guys, we make friends with people who make us laugh, have things in common with, and that's fine. But everybody should reserve part of their friendship and part of their time for people who they don't benefit anything from. People who are sick, people who are in the hospital, people who just got here from a different country, people who are not supported, who don't have a family support or a structural support, converts to the religion. We have a lot of them from what I understand in Utica. People you don't benefit anything from being with them. You take time out of your day, you say Bismillah, and guess what? Every second you spend with them is worship. Finally, last thing for the level of your individual self, putting your possessions in the service of Allah. Allah has blessed us here in this country with blessing upon blessing upon blessing, with wealth upon wealth. And the sign of gratitude is what you do with Allah's blessing. If I were to give you a gift, I give Ibrahim a gift of $100, give him a $100 bill. Say, you know what? Give this, you know, go out, buy something for your kids. And he takes that $100 and he just drops it on the floor and he walks away. Or he takes it and he uses it in a bad way. He goes out and buys lottery tickets or something like this. Is he grateful for the gift I gave him? Never. You can't ever say that such a person is grateful. Okay, Allah's given you eyesight. Allah's given you a house. Allah's given you a car. Allah's given you a job. Allah has given you a family and people who love you and a masjid. How you act with those things and how you treat those things is a reflection of your gratitude. You all know the story of Abu Bakr and Umar. Umar was always being outdone by Abu Bakr. And so when the time came for the Prophet ﷺ was raising an army, Umar was like, you know what, today's the day, I'm going to beat him. And he gathered half of his wealth and he came to offer half of his wealth to the Prophet ﷺ. Only to find that when he was on the way back, Abu Bakr had already come and given all of his wealth. You know the story of Uthman. When the Prophet ﷺ said, whoever buys this well and puts it in the service of the Muslims, then he will be in paradise. Uthman didn't hesitate. He jumped at the opportunity. He bought it. It's a waqf. The well of Uthman is still making money for Uthman today. If you go into Medina and you go to the government and you look at the property deed, it's under Uthman ibn Affan. It's a date farm. The dates are sold, the money is taken and given out to poor people. He's been collecting reward from Allah for 1400 years. Opportunities abound. That was the level of the self. Two major motions. Rescuing our worship from habit and then looking to those daily things we're already doing, converting them to worship. Now we're into the home. What do we do with our homes? The home has to be a place of prayer and it has to be a place of worship. The Prophet ﷺ, he said, لَا تَجْعَلُوا بُيُوتَكُمْ قُبُورًا. Don't let your homes become like graves. Don't make your homes into graves. The scholars, they talk about this hadith, excuse me, and they say one of the interpretations of this hadith is that the grave is a place where it is dead. There's nothing going on. There's no acts of worship happening there. Don't make your home a home where prayer doesn't happen. Don't make your home a home where the Quran isn't recited. The Prophet ﷺ, he told us about the many benefits of reciting different surahs in the home. He said that the home that Surah Al-Baqarah is recited in, the devil runs away from it. How you treat the prayer and how you prioritize the prayer sends a message to your children. Your children, they learn a lot from you, whether you know it or not. They pick up on your priorities. A lot of times they're sharper than we wish they were. Because we may say one thing to them, but we might do another. I'll give you an example. When it comes to the prayer, and we're at home, it's the weekend, what's our reaction? Are we dropping everything that we're doing? Most of us aren't. Are we telling the kids, hey, it's time to go. Let's everybody go make wudu, let's pray together. Is the adhan made in your home? Is the iqama made in your home? Little things. Versus, we've got a show on Netflix we want to watch. Let's make the popcorn. Come grab the sodas. Let's gather on the couch. It's a whole event the kids look forward to. You can actually turn the prayer into something like that. Obviously, the prayer is not going to be as entertaining for the kids as that. But to establish importance, your kids notice what are the things in your lives that you drop everything for. How you'll go out of your way for a work conference, or how you'll make all these sorts of compromises when it comes to things for money. However, what happens when Allah is giving us a simple call to respond to? Respond to this call. Is it permissible to pray whenever we want? Of course it is. It's not about permissibility. We're talking about best practices. There's bare permissibility, and then there's best practices. And we honestly and frankly, we live in a land and in a country and at a time where we can't get by with just bare permissibility. We need to implement in our homes best practices. So if you make the prayer into an event, if you can't get to the masjid, you make your prayer at home into an event that everybody participates in, this will send a message. It'll send a message to your children about how important the prayer is to you. And they will learn accordingly. Eating together. The Prophet ﷺ talked about eating together. This day and age, we're taking this one to soccer practice, and this one to school, and this one to this after school program. A lot of times we're on the run so much, we don't even get to eat together. The kids eat outside the home, or we eat something quick in the car. There was a group of people that came to the Prophet ﷺ, and they said, "Inna na'kulu wa la nashba." We eat, and we're never full. What was the Prophet's response? He said, eat together. If you eat together, you're going to find barakah. You're going to find blessing in your food. And you guys will also realize that when you take time to eat with your children as much as you are able to, you will strongly build your relationships with them. There's no secret that when you want to train an animal, you want to train a horse, or you want to train sheep, you use food. You hold it out to them whenever you want them to do something. Give them a little something every time, you know, positive reinforcement, whenever they do what you want them to do. Okay? No offense, kids. Kids are the same way. Human beings are the same way. The way to a man's heart, we say in English, the way to the man's heart is through his stomach. That's true. So when you sit together, you eat together, you share food, you laugh, and you, every single moment, it's not wasted. You're building your relationship, you're building your bond together. When you need to then instruct them later, it's going to mean something because your relationship is strong. Nurturing your relationships in general is something the Prophet ﷺ was very, very particular about and very, very masterful at. The companions were in love with the Prophet ﷺ to such an extent that they were upset and sad when they couldn't be with him. The way even the Prophet ﷺ looked at them, some of the companions, they said they were so shy from that they were too shy to even look up at him, at his eyes. But they remember all of these amazing memories from the time that they spent with him. If you turn to your relationships, you will find similar blessing in your life. Your spouse. Really, really important story. You know the story when the Prophet ﷺ is in the house of Aisha, and one of the other wives of the Prophet sends food. Okay? You know the story. And the Prophet ﷺ has guests over. There's people there eating. And Aisha gets jealous of the other wife because she's sending food and it's her day. What does Aisha do? The Prophet ﷺ has the food in his hand. Aisha slaps the wrist of the Prophet ﷺ, knocks the food out of his hand. Can you imagine you in the same situation with your spouse? What would you do? In front of guests. I hope that no one would get hurt. I hope that we wouldn't have to call the cops for all the noise and the yelling and the screaming or the arguing. I hope it wouldn't spill onto the street. The Prophet ﷺ, what did he do? He took the shards of the dish and he scraped up the food. He cleaned it himself. He wasn't like, "You're going to clean this mess. You made this mess." He cleaned it himself and he said to his guests, he made an excuse for his wife. Said, "Your mother is jealous." Very human thing. He covered for her. He had her back. He wasn't going to throw her under the bus. Because he understood, the Prophet ﷺ understood that his trade is with Allah. It's not with people. If you can get that in your mind, you'll succeed in everything. If you think that you're going to come down on your spouse because of something they did or something that they're not doing, why are you doing that? You're doing that because you think you're going to get something out of it. You think, if I react this way, I'm not going to be treated the right way, the way I want to be treated. Your trade is with people. And if your trade is with people, you're always going to be disappointed. If your trade is with Allah, and you realize that Allah controls people's hearts, then you will always be profitable, you will always be successful every single time. You don't act a certain way to somebody because you want them to act. That's business. That's trade. You act towards other people in a certain way because that's how Allah wants you to act, and Allah's control is controlling over everything. That's with your spouses. Your children are extremely important. Developing a strong relationship with your children. The Prophet ﷺ said, أَلَا كُلُكُمْ رَعٍ وَكُلُكُمْ مَسْؤُولٌ عَنْ رَعِيَّتِهِ. Every single one of you is a shepherd, and he is responsible for his flock. This doesn't mean that you have to go crazy. It doesn't mean that you have to become the big bad religious guy. It means you have to build a loving relationship with your child. It means you need to share laughs. You need to work to create memories. Think about the things that you remember from your childhood and your father, or maybe your mother, or your uncles, or whoever you had in your family. There are certain things that stick out, and this just plant love in your heart for those people. You should be actively thinking about making those sorts of memories for your kids. It's going to go a long way to developing your relationship with them. The Prophet ﷺ, he was busier than all of us. He was more responsible than all of us. He had the entire ummah to take care of. Forget about your business. Forget about your your projects. The Prophet ﷺ had the entire ummah that he had to take care of. And he still found the time to talk to children. He said to one of the children around him, Ya Abu Umar, ma fa'ala Nughayr? There's a little bird that the Prophet ﷺ, that this child had had as a pet. The Prophet ﷺ would ask him about his pet. He's the busiest man. The most intense worshiper of Allah. He wasn't this stoic, angry looking, you know, tough guy. He was honey. Every single person that comes to him, like, hey, how are you doing? He asks, he cares, he inquires. This is the type of attitude we have to have towards building our relationships. And finally, we talked about other relationships, perhaps most importantly, our parents and our relatives. For the older men and women among us, know that the way that you treat your relatives and your elders now is the way that your children are going to treat you one day. Again, going back to the vacation example, we find time for vacations, we find time for going to the amusement park, we find time for going to this festival and that festival, this dinner party and that dinner party. Are we finding time to go visit our relatives? Or calling them, even just calling them. A lot of us have relatives that live across the world. A regular calling time, involve the kids. Now we have video chat. The means have become so easy. We really don't have any excuse anymore. Final thing, and this has to be said, when it comes to our homes, technology and media, and monitoring how they enter our homes. None of you, I don't think, would invite into your home somebody who used foul language and somebody who dressed inappropriately in a revealing way and somebody who demonstrated crassness and meanness and poor qualities. You would not invite such a person into your home. However, you let your child sit on devices and look at these sorts of things day in and day out. What's the difference? The average age of exposure to pornography in the United States of America is 11 years old. 11 years old. What your child sees on a screen shapes their idea of what is normal. And what your child views as normal shapes their potential for what they can become and what they can do. We've become exposed because this day and age we look at things that should anger us. And they've become not only not angering to us, they've become entertainment for us. I think Game of Thrones is viewed by, I think, like 11 million or some crazy number of people. You know, Game of Thrones has idolatry in it. It has magic in it. It has many things that we can... If you go down the list of major sins, like Asab al-Muhlikat, it has most of them in there. Most of them. Like majority, at least four of them. Yet we're entertained by it. We're not angered by it. We too are subject to this dynamic. We too, our sense of normal can be skewed. And I don't think it'll take us very long to think about the other ways in which, over the decades, especially people in this society, our morality has been skewed by media and the media that we look at and what has become normal to us. Now, I know the common refrain, but I need a moment. The kids, they're overwhelming. Sometimes they just need something to occupy them for a little bit. I get that. That's true. And I agree with the problem, but I don't agree with the solution. Because every single time you give your child the phone, you are missing out on an opportunity to build your relationship with your child. It's ironic. They want our attention. And we don't want to give it to them. We give them the phone instead. And then when they're teenagers, we want their attention and they won't give it to us. And then we complain. Is that not true? Build your strong relationship with your child now. Don't turn your child over to media who do not have your best interests at heart to fill your child with false desires and all sorts of strange ideas. Now, don't confuse this as a call to sheltering. I'm not an advocate. It's not enough to just remove things. And obviously your kids, they go to school, they're going to be exposed to these things, whether you let your child do them or not, because other children have cell phones. It's never enough to just remove something. You always have to provide, substitute. And sometimes that requires hard conversations with your child. Sometimes that requires exposing your child to the concept of evil on your own terms before they're exposed to that evil from somebody else in a way that beautifies that evil. It's not easy. Not everybody can do it. But if you trust an adult in the community that can, I highly recommend it. All that was for the family. And we proceed to the final third we're talking about now on the level of community. Establishing Islam in our hearts and homes. At the level of community, what should we be doing? The first thing we're doing right now, food. The Prophet ﷺ, he said, "U'budu ar-Rahman wa at'imu at-ta'am wa afshu as-salam tadkhulu jannati bis-salam." He said, "Worship the Most Merciful, feed people, spread the salam, and you're going to enter paradise in peace." That was one of the first things Abdullah ibn Salam heard the Prophet ﷺ say when he made the hijrah to Medina. You guys are doing that now with these, mashallah, community dinners. A very, very good idea. But it's not enough to just keep it within the four walls. There's a whole city out there of people who don't know anything about Islam. Or worse, think they know something about Islam. Think they know something that's not true about Islam. And as we mentioned in the khutbah today, what I call biryani diplomacy can go a long way, right? That can be done at an individual level, inviting your neighbors into your homes, sharing meals with them, or it can be done at a community level. These sorts of things are very important. Gift giving was a sunnah of the Prophet ﷺ. Not expensive gifts, not intimidating gifts, small, frequent gifts. That's how the Prophet ﷺ was. A lot of times, I know how things go in the Muslim community, especially Ramadan. We invite people over to iftar. We intimidate people with the huge spread we have. MashaAllah, tabarakAllah, it's like free buffet. Then the person, what do they feel? They feel like they have to outdo and one-up the person the next time they invite them to their house. That's a barrier to meeting. It's a barrier to getting closer for a lot of times. Don't make that the criteria for every time you get together. Get together in each other's homes as much as possible. Just for coffee, just for tea, just for baklava, just for khir. Anything. It will go a long way. Turning to our children. One of the most important things that we can do for our children is guide them in the process of getting married. Guide them, but not control them. Okay? This is a very, very important. And there's two extremes. We talk about our children getting married. There's two extremes. There's one extreme that's completely negligent. They don't even think about that. They can't even imagine your child's going to get married one day. It's almost as if they just imagine they're just going to keep on just living at home and just, you know, doing the laundry, doing the food or whatever it is, and just someday, you know, the spouse is just going to descend from upon on high. Allah is going to send it down on a cloud. And then you're going to find the... No, you have to take the means. Allah created the asbab. Allah created the means. You have to take the means. That means that you should be talking to other people, finding out what's possible, helping your children get married and complete this obligation. Because guess what? If you don't, they're going to take it into their own hands. And you're probably not going to like the result when they do. At the same time, we can't be over-intrusive and over-intensive. A lot of us, we're here in the United States of America, and we expect our child to marry someone from the exact same ethnicity, the exact same social class, this particular family. We won't accept a family that's lesser in status than us. We'll accept one higher, but we're not going to go lower. This tribe and that tribe, and we don't mix with this tribe. Guess what? We're in America now. Most people who come to this country you have to choose the things you're going to keep. And this community is actually quite unique in how diverse it is. Meditate on this. The Prophet ﷺ, he said, there's a Sahih hadith that was narrated in the Sahih Ibn Hibban. He said, if someone comes to you in marriage and you're pleased with his religion and you're pleased with his character, Bismillah, marry them. If not, corruption will spread on earth. It's the same sort of thing that we just said. If you don't guide your child through the process, they're going to take matters into their own hands, leading to undesirable results. Have a plan. Have a candid conversation with them. How is it going to go down? Compromise with them. It will save you a lot in the long run. A lot of people, they wait until Fatima or Muhammad come home with somebody. And then you're so scared and freaked out that you just react and say no, 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 no. And push them further into taking matters in their own hands. It's not just about the marriage process. It's also about preparing your child for being married. What's marriage like? You know, every other religious community, they have like pre-marriage counseling, like the Christians and the Jews. They actually have the spouses, if they're engaged or whatever, they go on a retreat, or they go to a psychologist or something like this, somebody who's involved in marriage counseling, and they talk about the things that normally lead to divorce. And they try as much as possible to get on the same page before they actually get married. This is a very, very important thing. A lot of us, again, in the spirit of just ignoring it until it becomes a problem, our kids get their ideas of what marriage is like from television and movies. They think that they're just going to be staring into their spouse's eyes, you know, for eternity. It's not marriage. Marriage is sacrifice. Marriage is swallowing your pride. Marriage is negotiation. Marriage is one of the most difficult things in life. Marriage might take several attempts to get it right. No shame. So building those expectations is huge. If you don't, a lot of us don't. And then our kids get married and they find out it's not a garden of roses. It's hard work. And then everybody rushes to divorce. And we all know what happens then, especially in our community. Some people find it hard to get remarried after that. Finally, when it comes to our community, the masajid. And mashallah, tabarakallah, from what I understand, you guys have done a lot of work in planning and getting ready to build a masjid that's going to be not just a place to gather for prayer, but something that is going to be like the masjid of the Prophet ﷺ. Something that was a community hub. Something that at the same time was a university. At the same time was a place to distribute charity. And at the same time was a place where administrative decisions happened. And guests were received. And delegations were entertained. This is the masjid at the time of the Prophet ﷺ. It wasn't just a place where you come to pray. But we don't have to stop there. There's other things that we can be doing. Other institutions that need to be built. Schools. Gyms. Youth spaces. Things that aren't wild pie in the sky dreams. Things that other religious communities have. Even in Utica. Look at the Catholic communities. Look at the Jewish communities. They have these things. How do they have these things? I'll tell you how they have these things. This is the last part, inshallah. We'll conclude with this. Perhaps more than anything, what's going to determine the success of this community 20 years from now is its ability to be financially independent. What do we mean by that? We are the only religious community in the United States of America that collects its money for its religious leaders, for the lights, for the food, by passing around the hat. By locking the doors on the 27th of Ramadan and saying, all right, you're not leaving until we make the number. This is insanity. The Christians don't do this and the Jews don't do this. They own property. They collect rent. They own businesses. They invest in stock. They do these things that make them not have to come and ask and beg the people every year to keep the lights on. They take that money. I'll make it very, very plain for you. Let's imagine two communities, community A, community B. Community A wants to build a masjid. Masjid costs $1 million. Community A, they fundraise for years, trying to get this amount of money to build the building. It ends up costing a little bit more than they expected. Things go wrong in the construction process. It ends up being more than they expected. But they finally get their masjid. And then what? The community's tapped dry, and they don't have enough money to pay a good imam. They don't have enough money to pay Arabic teachers. They don't have enough money to expand or to create other institutions. That's community A. They're in a very, very tenuous position. They're in a very vulnerable position when it comes to their long-term future, their long-term sustainability. Community B. Community B wants to build a masjid as well. Price tag's $1 million. They spend 5 years raising $1 million, but they take that $1 million and they buy a block of city apartments, they turn them into condos, and they collect rent. They make back the money that they spent in another 4 or 5 years. And they use that money to build a masjid. And they're still collecting rent after that every single year. So in another 5 years, they can build an Arabic school or an Islamic school. In another 5 years, they can build a gym. In another 5 years, they start to buy the apartment buildings around their masjid. And they can give them in subsidized rents for people in low incomes. This is planning. This is thinking 20 years down the road. This is something that most Muslim communities aren't thinking at that level. But now you can think at that level because I just told you. Secret's out of the bag. You guys are there. You're at a golden, you guys raised $150,000 to $200,000. I was just in a community in a suburb of Philadelphia that is almost all doctors and lawyers and engineers. That's wealthier than you guys. That's bigger than you guys. People drive Teslas there. And they could not raise $150,000 in the month of Ramadan. You're at a critical point when it comes to your community. And you have a critical opportunity in front of you. Don't just plan for the step ahead. Plan for the next 10 steps ahead. Put yourself in a position now where you can be independent. Where you can have the infrastructure. Where you can accommodate growth. Where you can do what you need to do as things come up. If we do these things, then we will have taken care of our responsibility to Allah. Everything we've talked about. We talk about the love of the individual, reclaiming our worship from habit, picking up every single habit that we do and incorporating it into our worship. We nurture our relationships. We build our community. We plan for the future. That's taking care of the responsibility Allah asked us to. When Allah told us, protect your family from the fire that consumes people and stones. When the Prophet ﷺ said, every single one of you is a shepherd, and he's responsible for his flock. If we do these things, we will have established Islam, truly, in the United States, in Utica, New York. We'll have established Islam in our hearts and homes. Wallahu ta'ala a'lam, walhamdulillah, wassalatu wassalam ala rasulillah. That's it. Thank you very much for your patience. I know it was a little bit long. If anybody has questions, I'd like to move to the ladies' questions first. And then, inshallah, we will move to the gentleman.